So here we go. We're off. Security. So good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. Good to see lots of familiar faces coming on. I'm just going to take off the screen that some of you have been looking at for a while. Share, and here we go. Everybody, see you. Here's Michael. So good to see you all. Lots of people coming on now. Good to see so many familiar faces in the audience. We've missed you. This is the relaunch of News and Views. Everybody, feel free to chat in the chat to say hi to one another. As you remember, this event is primarily about networking and among like-minded people. Who are eager for change. Many of you are putting your cameras on, which is great, good to see you all. And so this is for people in the Brussels bubble, eager for change, seeking inspiration and ideas. We got a great guest with you, but before we go to meet Michael, this is a relaunch of News and Views. And we are here to provide you with news about political communication, and to hear your views. So feel free to share, ask questions in the chat. Julia is going to curate your questions and your views a little bit later on. Everybody's waving, that's great. So today we have a muse to inspire you on this cold spring afternoon. And we're delighted to welcome Michael Peel from the Financial Times. He is, and I'll read, European diplomatic correspondent and also author of a book called The Fabulous. And this book is all about, he's showing you that now, this book is all about how myth makers rule in an age of crisis. Today we will finally face up to the world we live in, and that's the promise of the book. So I'll read from the back cover. We are plagued by leaders who mislead and repress. It's more important than ever to stand up to them. The COVID-19 catastrophe has exposed the fabulists who rule throughout the world in dictatorships, democracies, and hybrids of the two. The misinformation they spread and the fake policy solutions they tout have become their own pandemic. Here, Michael vividly recounts ferocious international battles over truth and the right to tell it. From Britain's struggle with itself over Brexit to Syria's civil war, he reveals the trademark deceptions and the powerful interests that profit from them in the defining fight of an era. And just a little more on Michael, as if the book is not enough to inspire you. Michael has reported from the FT, for the FT from Southeast Asia, the Middle East and West Africa, and he's now with us close by in the Brussels bubble. He's author of A Swamp Full of Dollars, Pipelines and Paramilitaries at Nigeria's Oil Frontier, which was shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award and nominated for the Orwell Prize. So Michael, welcome.
How Thank you, Joe. I shall try to live up to your billing. Very kind of you.
So before we start to break through the fables spun by autocrats and figure out what that means for advocacy, let's talk first about you, if that's okay. You as a journalist. So what brought you into journalism, Michael?
Well, Joe, I grew up in the southwest of England, and I guess I can retrofit this story as we all do with our own narratives, and perhaps suitably for a story about narratives. But it was a very turbulent time in British politics when I was growing up. Of course, it was the height of the Thatcher era, and I had parents who were both in education, and in a very sort of understated way, but an exemplary one, they kind of got me thinking about questions of social justice and fairness. And then later on, when I became more, when I grew up and became more sort of engaged with politics, and I was captivated by stories of repression, and especially some David against Goliath type struggles. And two examples are the battle of Aung San Suu Kyi against the generals in Myanmar in the 1990s, and also in the Niger Delta, the struggles of Ken Saro-Wiwa and other activists, which of course ended with the execution of him and eight of his colleagues. And I did student journalism, met people, enjoyed the kind of slightly dilettante-ish aspect of journalism as well, the excuse just to like look under stones and call people up. And in the end, that led me to apply for various jobs, of which the Financial Times, rather against my expectations, gave me one. And the rest is history. I'm still here almost 25 years later.
Wow. So tell us a bit more about your career and like what you're doing now.
So I've had this perhaps uniquely FT career where I've ranged from doing jobs such as being at one stage the tax and accountancy correspondent, which you can imagine broke the ice at parties, but also had, as you recounted, quite an extensive international experience working outside of the UK for Times. And the first of those was in Nigeria, where I ended up covering the very battle for oil that had captivated me at university. And that got me thinking even more about the powers that shape our world. And I guess that became a kind of theme of my career, so that I ended up, for example, in the Middle East, walking quite unintentionally into an age of revolution. I turned up in Abu Dhabi in January 2011, and within a week, the Tunisian president had fled the country, and it went from there. And then, of course, in Southeast Asia, a great story was the rise of China in the region, from already a significant sort of position of influence. But all the time, you know, I loved not just the grand geopolitics, but the stories of the people, whether they were Syrian artists or, you know, Thai solar energy capture entrepreneurs. And you know, it's that richness that you get in journalism, particularly with the Financial Times, that has riveted me for almost a quarter of a century.
So that's super, what an amazing career, actually, super interesting to see the world from so many perspectives. So about the Financial Times, the Financial Times is the international newspaper. So what sets it apart, and what sets a Financial Times journalist apart from the kind of the main media, national level, regional, it's quite a unique beast.
It is in some ways. I mean, I think I would answer that question in two ways. One is to say that journalism is journalism, however it's practiced. It's, you know, it's not a profession, it's a trade. You know, it's not like being a doctor or an accountant or a lawyer, where you have qualifications that you simply have to have or you can't practice. And so anyone can and should be a journalist. And obviously the rise of the digital age has led a thousand flowers of citizen journalism bloom. Has a darker side too, as we well know, but there have been positive sides. I come from that starting point that basically everything I write, I try to make it something that could be engaging to anyone who is literate and curious, you know, wherever in the world they are, and whether they understand or have deep knowledge about the subject at hand or not. But clearly, as you say, the slightly deeper answer is that the FT is a London-based paper, and well, I use the word paper, that shows my antecedents and my age, but a London-based organisation, and in that sense it has its origins in the UK, but it's always been extremely international, has a very large network of correspondents around the world, and for the last five or so years has of course been owned by Nikkei of Japan, which has added to the kind of international flavor of the whole business. And you know, we do try to sort of look at the bigger picture, not to be parochial in our reporting, and to try to sort of always be picking out the bigger and often very international themes.
Yeah, I mean, the big themes of economics, of social justice. I mean, there's a lot of intersectionality about how these different issues weave together in in today's world. I mean, thinking of our audience, you know, we have on the line, we have today campaign directors, heads of communication, people working in Brussels, the Brussels bubble and EU kind of influence campaigning for change. Given that audience, what would you say? Would you share some insights? So what would it take? What does it take for this kind of audience to get a story in the FT? I mean, we know if you're a CEO of a big, interesting, progressive company, then that's probably more easy. But what does it take for campaign groups, change makers, progressives, to get coverage in the Financial Times?
So I think an ideal story marries a tight focus on something with a wider resonance. And you know, we are so we're interested in developments, whether they're in policy or corporate practices or a social movement, as you say, but also something that speaks to a bigger trend. So those stories are very much in a stock in trade for us. And of course, you know, we want all our stories to be well founded. So particularly where data is concerned, you know, we want to be sure that the data itself is rigorous and you know that it is something on which a solid story can be based. And that also, I would say that data is even more important in our thinking now than ever because of the very rich visual aspect that digital journalism has brought. And you know, obviously, colleagues of mine have been doing amazing things visually with graphics and videos and animations and so on. And clearly, the pandemic has provided a very good example of that. The COVID vaccine, well, initially the COVID infection tracker, and then the COVID vaccine tracker, which has still followed, which you know, are genuinely innovative things, which have you know, got a lot of attention, and particularly early in the pandemic, were very widely cited and used.
Okay. So we're going to come back to that later, because that's obviously a really large part of why people are kind of tuning in today, because they really, I mean, in terms of the God, in a way, even though you say it's a very kind of, like any other media, the Financial Times does carry influence. I mean, we can kind of come a little bit later also to your specific role as European diplomatic correspondent, because it's an interesting name. So what does that really mean? But I want to get onto your book, because it's a really exciting name, The Fabulists. And so maybe you could just tell us what motivated you to write this.
Yeah, so this emerged over the best part of a decade of reporting, or even more, and this sense that in all of these different places, culturally, historically, socially, quite country in many ways, there were common themes of leadership which involved misleading narratives. You know, that stretches from straightforward lies and propaganda to sins of omission, if you like, of presenting presenting a policy or a history in a certain way that omitted any counter evidence. And as you read at the blurb at the back, what I found most sort of striking was that this wasn't just something that dictatorships do, as they obviously have done for years, but that leaders in democracy were doing more and more. And I felt that this was a sort of a worrying trend, which in one sense, you know, you can say it's nothing new and that there have been, you know, dubious stories for as long as we've had the ability to communicate to each other. But it does seem to me that there is a way in which, partly because of social media, obviously, but partly because of the time pressures and the pressures of work and in some cases sheer survival, people, you know, are often have less time to engage with things deeply. I mean, I certainly feel that for myself, and also that a lot of leaders have learned that shamelessness pays, and so it's they won't bother even to correct the record as they might have been forced to do in the past, and that you know, have realized that they're perhaps not going to be punished at the ballot box for things that previously they might have thought they they would be. And so I thought that was sort of, you know, there was enough in there and enough sort of really vivid stories ranging from Saudi Arabian activists to the cult of the Thai monarchy to, you know, the battle over Brexit to really sort of bring out some of that richness and give some real food for thought. And finally, it's also a story of resistance, and this is really important, that, you know, there are a lot of brave people out there who have paid very heavily with their liberty and even their lives, in some cases, from the jailed Philippine senator Leyla de Lima to, of course, here in Europe, the murdered Maltese journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole world of complexity, and also, I mean, in a way, chaos. I mean, is this a new mainframe, political mainframe for the chaotic world we live in, which is very fast moving, as you say? Politicians, leaders can maybe obfuscate the truth, and perhaps there's not enough checks and balances in the system. Or they're not moving fast enough to really hold them to account. And so I kind of think that, I mean, I would just say in the chat, by the way, for the audience, if you want to ask questions, do put those in the chat. Julia's going to curate a whole session of questions. So feel free to put them in the chat, where you're going to come onto a question chunk of sessions and bring the audience views in a moment. But I just wanted to kind of get back to the book and think, well, given the new mainframe, the new political mainframe, what does that really mean for the people in the audience today? What does that mean for people, progressives, trying to affect change? Because if the system has fundamentally changed, how do the actors then have to adjust their tactics or their strategies to really affect change?
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting question. And obviously, the hardest in one sense, but actually I think there are certain sort of principles which are quite important. I mean, first of all, to sort of frame what I'm going to say and what I just said, I think it's sometimes presented as a kind of battle against truth and lies, but actually I'd put it a little bit more subtly and say that the battle is between those who still have a regard for trying to find the truth and those who've abandoned any pretense of trying to tell it. And that makes a lot more sense to me in some ways, because you know, the truth can be a slippery thing, right? And it's not always clear you know, what it is, or it may be that, you know, there is no sort of particular objective truth on a particular point. And so I think the first lesson of that is don't overclaim. You know, you sometimes see people falling into the trap of, because there's a trend that they don't like, whether it's you know, the rise of Duterte in the Philippines, or or Brexit, that, or whatever, that to say, well, you know, this is clearly wrong. This is clearly, you know, clearly something that cannot be justified. Well, often they're talking about things that are subjective, and, you know, like it or not, you know, there are many people who believe that Rodrigo Duterte is a savior of the Philippines. Now, you know, one can just sort of dismiss that and refuse to engage. But of course, the Kenya activists don't do that. They engage, and engagement is obviously hugely important. And the Philippines, actually, I found is a really good example of that, because I found myself in a lot of dialogues with people who would tell me about how much they supported Duterte despite this incredibly bloody drugs war that he was pursuing, and, you know, despite his rampant misogyny and his many other vices. But then you go talking to them a bit, and they'll give you, you know, often a more qualified answer. And one example which I quote in the book was of a guy who, you know, started off saying the president is great, you know, we need to crack down on drugs. And I said, well, but a lot of people are dying. Does that worry you at all? And he said, well, you know, okay, it'd be better if they didn't, but, you know, this is a very serious problem for us. And I said, but do you think that, you know, there's a possibility when people take drugs that, you know, that doesn't everyone deserve a sort of second chance of redemption? And the guy that said to me, well, you know, he said, I think you're right, because I used to be, you know, I used to take crystal meth. For many years, and then you know, I got into some very, very bad crowd, and in the end I had to move away from my own place, and I started a new life, and I got a girlfriend, and we have a baby daughter now, and my life's so much better. And he ended the conversation with this really sympathetic sort of account from the heart of how it is possible to change. And I was just, you know, it didn't need saying in the end, but the, you know, unspoken was, if this guy had been doing this 5 years later, he would have ended up dead in Duterte's drugs war. So that engagement's really important. And I think how you approach people as a sort of dialectic, asking questions, you know, not necessarily sort of saying to people, well, you're just wrong, but, you know, asking things in an interrogative way, you know, do you think that, do you worry that? And that kind of, in some ways, sort of forces people to think a bit more and can sometimes lead them to, you know, perhaps conclusions that they hadn't sort of immediately considered. And finally, I would say, obviously, the flip side is a certain humility, which is that, you know what, you might have a conversation with one or multiple people where actually what they tell you makes you review the way you've been looking at a problem. So it definitely cuts both ways.
Yeah, so a bit more open conversation, a little bit more reflection. But of course, in the world of politics and headline news, there's not often the chance to get below the surface of that. Let me pass now to Julia, who's going to curate a little bit and open up the floor for questions. Hi, Julia. I'm going to allow to see themselves and to unmute themselves, but I'll leave it for Julia to tell you when you can and who's got an interesting question. So over to Julia. Yes, go.
Okay, you've just allowed us to unmute ourselves. Thank you. I'm also one of the participants on this. Yes, so we've got a very shy audience who so far haven't asked any questions. So please put your questions in the chat. But maybe I can take an opportunity to ask a question. I work as a communications manager in Brussels and have done for several years. It's really fascinating to listen to what you're talking about, especially in the context we're all working with now on the EU level and some of the situations we're facing. I would just really like to hear a bit, as Joe said, about your career in Brussels. What then brought you to Brussels, and what is it that you personally are covering at the moment, and how is the FT office set up at the moment in Brussels? What do we come to you with, and how do we sort of develop the, I'm sure a lot of people do already and we do, but how do we develop our contacts with yourselves?
Thanks, Julia. And perhaps just before I go on, I could just go back very quickly to a point, Joe, that you made just then about how it's kind of difficult to cut through to people with complexity. But I think that there are some people who've been very successful at doing that, whether it's politicians like Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez and the viral videos that she does, or in a journalistic sense, the kind of explainers that Ros Atkins has been doing on, you know, vaccines or Brexit or whatever, which are 4 or 5 minutes and have been really, really successful. And I think that there's real, as things get more complex, you know, there's a real value in high quality explanatory material. And I think that's something that, you know, we should bear in mind. There is actually the flip side of people being very busy is that there is an appetite for explanatory material if it's of a high quality. To go back to your question, Julia, so we are, excitingly, we've just expanded in the FT Brussels office because we've just launched our new, revamped newsletter, which comes out every morning, called Europe Express. And it's helmed by the brilliant Valentina Pop, who has just joined us from the Wall Street Journal. Look out for that. And it shows that we're really stepping up our Europe coverage, we now have a sort of a new person devoted to that, and that gives you news and views from all over the continent in your inbox every morning. And Val adds to our current stable of reporters here, and we have Sam Fleming is the bureau chief and is across everything. And I do the diplomatic job, which means it's a foreign policy, defense, security, also some other subjects, migration, rule of law. Mehreen Khan, my colleague, covers green issues, and again is it does a lot of stuff over a lot of subjects, financial stuff and so forth. Javier Espinoza covers competition and tax. And Jim Brunsdon, who many of you will know, he's been in Brussels for a very long time, does trade, Brexit and other matters. But, you know, we have beats, but we, you know, obviously Brussels is a kind of fungible place and there are lots of things that sort of cut across different things that, that we do. And we also have finally Alan Beattie, who does commentary, particularly on trade, and helms our trade secrets newsletter.
So what is exactly your European diplomatic correspondent? What does that mean actually? You hang out at cocktail parties or?
Sorry, say that again?
You hang out at cocktail parties?
Yeah, well, not so much over the past year, sadly, but yeah, I mean, it's basically the EU in the world. So whether that's, you know, transatlantic relations or dealing with Russia or the rise of China, that's my stock in trade. But also, you know, thematic, big thematic issues, such as, for example, I've done quite a bit on so-called golden passports, citizenship by investment schemes, looked at international organizations sometimes. A while back I did stuff on Interpol and the concerns that that's become a tool of authoritarian states. So there's some license to, you know, get involved in the stories of the moment, but also, you know, in some of the cracks in the coverage. You know, an organization like Interpol is a good example that nobody really covers it. Everyone knows it, but nobody actually covers it. And so I got involved in that. And I also cover NATO, so, you know, security at an EU and a NATO level as well. And as I said, there are these other elements, the rule of law, for example, within the EU, that's something I've covered quite a bit and have an interest, as you see from the book, of, you know, there's a sort of, in a sense, it's an example of the fragility of things, how, you know, states that were at some point democratic start sliding into something that is, might not be dictatorship, but it's not actually, it's not a democracy anymore.
And do you get into the green diplomacy? Because of course green diplomacy for the European Commission with the European Green Deal right now is a big deal for them. And of course they would, the European institutions would like to export that kind of level of ambition around the world. Is that something that the world is ready for, in your view?
Yes, I mean, I think that in a sense that the pandemic has sort of put everything back almost by a year, because clearly the Green Deal was, you know, one of the flagship policies, if not the flagship policy of the new Commission when it took office at the end of 2019. Then the pandemic intervened, I mean, literally within weeks of it taking over. So, but now we see it gathering pace again, you know, partly because the pandemic has moved to a different phase, partly because there's a new US administration which actually wants to engage with this, and partly, of course, with COP 26 is now coming up, having been postponed last year. And I mean, as I said, my colleague Nehreen is the lead on green matters, but it is something that, as you suggest, cuts across many, many issues. And I think, for example, the push, which we've started to write about recently, a bit more of by the EU and other powers to present alternatives to China's Belt and Road Initiative, green projects are going to be a really, really important part of that potentially. So yeah, it definitely has that kind of strategic and geopolitical quality.
Yeah, I mean, so there is hope. I mean, there is hope that now with the new US administration, there is a more progressive, at least a partner in the world with the European Commission, as well as several other countries and regions. But given your book and your insights into this kind of changed construct, how can we kind of overcome these misleading narratives?
So I think a lot of it is just about sort of honesty and just sometimes just acknowledging complexity. You know, people, it always seems to me a sort of paradox of politics that you know, politicians often seem quite patronizing, that they don't give people the credit for, you know, that they might want to sort of engage with and understand nuanced arguments, and that it's and that everything has to be sort of set at a very crude level. And I think that, you know, there is a lack of clear political jargon-free communication. And I think that it's interesting to go back to the Green Deal, that one of the big tests of this will be that, you know, one of the grave mistakes, I think it's now clear, of capitalism across the world, is that as old heavy industries were phased out, there was nowhere near enough done to help the people who were thrown out of work to rebuild their livelihoods in other fields. Now, clearly, the Green Deal explicitly tries to address that through the so-called just transition mechanism, which is supposed to divert funds to places like Poland, where, you know, you'll have coal-fired power stations closing down and so on. And I think that is a massive test for the EU, obviously, but also for sort of for early 21st century capitalism itself, as to whether those lessons have been learned and whether, you know, authorities can persuade people with an agenda which says, look, these industries are polluting and they need to be closed down, but we totally, you know, we see the grave impact this is going to have on you and your life, and we need to help you with that, and we will help you every step of the way. So I think, you know, there's going to be that big social test as well.
Yeah, I mean, when we think about NGOs operating in Brussels, we think about them traditionally with kind of on specific single issues or kind of sectors like environment or development. But today we see the kind of blending of that. So we see environmental groups working on economic reform. We see development organizations also working on gender, environment. So we see a kind of cross-fertilization of ideas across the different NGOs, and also the need to kind of figure out the complexity and how these different issues fit together. And if we think about what you just said about the insights of the book, I mean, what is the link between then populism and kind of information? Because if most people don't get that information, then how can they be expected to challenge the information at the same time?
Yeah. So I think the answer to that is that there are still platforms out there which people will engage with, and it's a question of establishing trust, and establishing that you realize what people's concerns are. And I mean, that, you know, I think that's a common theme of all of the reporting I've done around the world. I mean, you know, without being too sort of broad brush or romantic about it, and obviously I've met some fairly unpleasant people in various places over the years, but my experience is that most people, most of the time, are very happy, even glad, to engage in you know, a reasonable conversation about something, even when they might start off being skeptical of what you have to say. And I think, you know, that the word authenticity I really don't like in politics, because I think it's been much sort of abused and become a bit meaningless. But I think you can usually tell when you engage with someone whether they really, you know, they really care about what you care about, right? I think that sort of sincerity is something that is fairly transparent, and I think that's something that, you know, on the one hand, yes, there've been a rise of a lot of charlatans, the Trumps of this world, but on the other hand, there is this other strand, particularly among younger people, who are looking for people who have substance and have a bit of passion, a bit of fire in their bellies, the AOCs of this world. And I think that's a kind of spirit that will come more and more to dominate. And I recommend, by the way, on this vein, my colleague, my excellent colleague Sarah O'Connor, who writes on employment and, you know, the world of work and the future of work and many other things besides, did a very good piece recently about how younger people view the post-pandemic world. And what was very striking is how even people who were in, you know, what one consider quite good, well-paid jobs were very sort of apocalyptic about, you know, my pension will be, you know, battling in the climate wars and stuff like that. So, although we're in an age which seems very sort of dominated by kind of the Trumpian side of life, well, he's gone, and there are sort of other changes which are gradually happening in politics around the world, not least in the United States.
So in a general sense, you feel like this trend, the book, the topic of your book, is not a forever trend, that we can be optimistic that democracy can heal itself and can actually improve in terms of the quality and the representativity.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I would say there are two messages in the book. One is that, look, we have to get real about, you know, what's going on and not sort of delude ourselves. And we kind of owe it. We owe it to ourselves, really, not to, get behind leaders who give sort of comforting but misleading bromides about how everything's okay, really, and we don't have to worry about climate change and all the rest of it. You know, so we need to look at things as they are. But on the other hand, the book is really not meant to be, and I hope it doesn't come across as a counsel of despair, because in the long run, I think people do get found out if they are denying reality to the extent that some leaders are today. And, you know, that might not be immediate. It might not be a kind of full accountability, but things do change. Nothing is immutable. And as I say, there is this broad sort of swathe of people who are resisting these trends and are trying to sort of push for something a bit better. So, you know, there's definitely a kind of recalibration in world affairs, that is true. And clearly, you know, this is a world in which, authoritarian states, starting with China, are becoming more and more influential. But it's a mistake also to sort of think of these trends as completely unchangeable, or that that they eclipse everything else. And China's an interesting example, because clearly there has been a backlash over both the way that China has approached other powerful countries, but also over projects that it has backed in some poorer countries, where they now feel saddled with debt, or they feel the work or the environmental standards were too low. You know, China's great offer and was years ago, starting in Africa, look, we will do these infrastructure projects. We are your friends. We don't have the colonial baggage. We're not going to lecture you like these Western countries do. And there was space to move into there because, of course, as I recount in my book in Nigeria, the record of Western governments and companies in Africa was one of, you know, resource plunder and colonialism and slavery, you know, in history. So there was fertile ground there. But now, after the initial promises, there's something of a reckoning going on in some of these countries like Kenya, where, you know, there's a very lively debate about, you know, the role of China and have we got sort of too far into bed with them. So, these things are always changing. They are always switching around, and, you know, the moment must always be grabbed.
Interesting. So we have some questions now from our timid audience, but I just want a quick opinion. Do you think, capitalism, which has run its course in the way we see it now, in terms of just some of the issues you talked about. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're a little bit quiet, Jo. Is there any way of boosting your sound?
Yeah, I'm not sure why I'm so quiet today. I'm going to lean in. Is that better?
Yeah, a bit better, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why. I've no idea why I'm a bit quiet today. Technology always fails at the moment you don't want it to, right? No, my question relates to capitalism, in fact. This is the big thread, of course, which many NGOs and progressives would say actually the impact of globalization, those of us who were in this kind of movement of questioning the benefits to society 20 years ago, have all of our predictions actually have probably come true. There has been, as you just mentioned, quite a bit of plunder going on around the world. There's been quite a lot of the rich getting richer. And now we see there's a very tiny proportion of people who have a massive amount of wealth in the world. I mean, so all of that is a consequence of capitalism. So I guess my question is, as the guy at the FT, and on which I guess the paper was founded, not in a naive sense is it dead, but how should it be reformed or modified to suit the modern world and the needs of the modern world?
Nice small question there. Yeah, I think you put your finger on it, and I think that this definitely resonates with my own history, because when I came back from Nigeria was very sort of formative to me in that it was the problems, the scale of the problems of the oil industry were unhideable. Not only were they unhideable, but oil companies themselves often openly admitted that, at least some of them. So I remember one day, must have been in about 2005, Chevron took out newspaper whole page adverts for the mea culpa of how the terrible effects that its social policies in the Niger Delta had had. I mean, it was an extraordinary piece of sort of corporate PR, but in a sense, it was no more than sort of laying out what was obvious to anyone who visited. So, I've always had that sense of, that there being something very, very, very wrong with the way that the current system is. And I think that, the last 15 to 20 years have definitely proved that. And I think if you look at Financial Times editorials more recently, which I don't write, but they're calling for quite significant changes to the way that economies are run, the way we view development, corporate behavior, and so on. And I think that there is a sort of an evolution there for sure. And of course, it's well noted in the US, you had Joe Biden giving a speech last night, which it's hard to imagine a president of recent vintage, even Democratic ones, giving in his place. And not that Joe Biden's a lifelong radical, but he is responding to changes and needs that he and other people who've been campaigning and in the Democratic Party and elsewhere will also see as crucial at this point. And so I think there is a moment to be seized there and to make some of these changes. And I think that the Green Deal is potentially an important example of that. I mean, it's a serious program.
Yeah, and the time is now, exactly. Yeah. It seems like the time is now, because there are several progressive, there are big UN summits this year, in terms of policy change. So there is some momentum in the air. And there's also momentum amongst our audience who've started to reflect, and we've got a couple of questions. So Julia, do you want to get the people who've asked questions to come on? Julia, can we hear you? Hello, anybody there?
Julia sent a message saying you need to allow me. You may have blocked mics.
I've now got my mic back on. It's Joey's hosting, Joe's in charge. So I think everyone's mic should be allowed now and unblocked, so people can ask their own questions. So the first question, well, we've got two questions in the chat, and they're both really about approaches and the content, kind of content you want and so on. So the first speaker would be Anika, if you could ask your question, followed by Gianluca. So if you could say your name and where you work and then ask your question, that would be great to know who we're hearing from.
Sure. Hello, my name is Annika and I work for the Society of Audiovisual Authors dealing with the audiovisual film sector representing the filmmakers. I have a background working with human rights for many years. And my question was a bit about, I'm working on, my job today is very much to work on pretty technical specific issues. It's very much on the copyright, intellectual property rights. And I always find, especially in these times when we work online and we have our events online and all the communication is digital, to balance between, on the one hand, address a very niched expertise group of policymakers, stakeholders in Brussels, seeing them for their own expertise and giving them something that is a bit more in depth. And we need to keep our events shorter, so it's something we can take in online. While at the same time not being, I would say, disregard a more general public that still is interested in the topics. So it's the way of providing the really meaty, how you would say, content, and at the same time making sure that you're not speaking above someone's head. This is also, of course, an issue in writing, but I think especially online nowadays and in any types of communication. So my question was for you, how do you see this, the balance between the public and the very specific audience and the content to be, technical, informed, useful, valuable?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point, and I would go back maybe to some of the ideas that I mentioned earlier, which is that you can pack, particularly on video, you can pack a lot into a short space of time. And I do recommend these BBC explainers, which I mentioned earlier, as a really good example of that. And, we definitely use visuals more in our attempts to tell stories digitally, and I think that we find that they're very popular, particularly obviously if they're interactive, which is such as the COVID the COVID graphics often are, and I think. Yeah, I grew. It's interesting. I a while back I rewatched some of the TV programs of my youth presented by people like Jacob Bronowski, which were very much kind of, the presenter told you about human civilization, and the thing is, okay, they had their faults. The production values were and the format looked old and dated in some ways, but they got an audience. And actually, I think there still is an audience. I think people crave stories. That's a big message for the book, and if you have a good story to tell and you tell it well, and you take something very specific, a personal story of somebody who, is affected by climate change, or whose life could be changed by the Green Deal, and you use that to talk about the more abstract political matter in hand, then that remains an extremely effective tool. A stock in trade of journalism for many years, and there's a good reason for that. It works.
Great, that's a great tip, Michael. Storytelling, and to bring policy to life. Thanks so much, Annika. Next question.
Next, I think it was Gianluca. There he is.
Here I am. Hi, thanks a lot for this. I'm Gianluca. I'm communications officer at PICOM, which is a short acronym for long name. We've actually been recently in touch regarding access to the vaccine for undocumented migrants in Europe. So that's what we do. We we fight for the rights of undocumented migrants in Europe for everybody. My question is very, very practical, and it's about the kind of information that you as a journalist, as a Financial Times journalist, and maybe you know you or your colleagues look for or hope to find in a Brussels-based NGO. So, you know, you're very, very much aware, I'm sure, that as regional networks, as people working in this ivory tower that is the Brussels bubble, we're not able to provide interesting human stories. But you know, and I have some ideas of what can be interesting for a journalist, but what's really the trigger for you to you know, get in touch with somebody with a Brussels-based NGO? What is it that you're looking for from us?
Well, as you say, I mean that European spread is very, very important, and I mean obviously in the work you do on undocumented migrants, clearly there's a big story in Belgium about that itself, but also in many other European countries. And I think that there are lots of organizations who we definitely use or present themselves as gateways to a wider European story. And I think it's it's definitely worth considering sort of making that, and I'm not commenting on your own website because I haven't looked at it in detail, but just to make these things very, very clear on websites, particularly in the media contact section, just to say, well, we have a network of X countries, and we can put you in touch with experts or talking to people who are involved and face some of the problems that we're talking about if they're willing to speak and so on. So it's well worth being explicit about that, and a well sort of conceived, well navigated website is extremely important. I mean, there are still organizations, and again, this is not a comment on yours, but in general, still organizations where it's actually quite hard to find out who to get in touch with first off. The kind of media contact is not immediately obvious. Sometimes those are organizations that don't really want to speak to the media, so that's the reason, but other times they are organizations that definitely do, but they just haven't sort of designed and been explicit and clear enough.
Great. Well, thank you, Gianluca, for asking that question. I'm not sure if we have other questions. Otherwise, I will proceed to probably ask one big question, which is along the lines as well, also of what we were just talking about with Gianluca, which is along the lines of what are your top tips, therefore, for progressives, those guys who want to reform the capitalist system, as well as those guys who want to speed up progress and scale and speed change in business, in NGOs, in think tanks. What are your top tips aside from tell a great story and link it to some global policy initiative? Get your data, really clear, comprehensive, independent, backed up by solid organizations. Beyond that, what would you say is really important to fill the Financial Times pages of progressive waves of change?
Another small question. I mean, I think the why it matters shtick is more important than it has ever been, and I think that. Being as practical as possible. I mean, being brief initially, and just acknowledging the fact that we're all drowning in email, and it's the old sort of the old cliche about the letter. I'm sorry, I wrote a long letter because I didn't have time to write a short one. Clearly, if something like a story for the Financial Times, if something's written crisply and you can see that somebody's made the effort to really sharpen their idea, of course that immediately is more attractive. So that's definitely something that that helps, and also just, you know, to be prepared to talk it through. And, you know, I often find working on stories that I talk to editors or contacts, and I'm not always clear myself what the story is at the start, but it's through those conversations that it becomes clearer. And it may be that the story that is initially pitched is not quite the story that would most interest us, but that there's some angle of it or aspect of it or something related to it which we do think is really interesting.
Right, so that's a really great tip for everybody. So really figure out why it matters, and I guess also to who. I mean, we always say, years ago, I remember starting NGO campaigns 20 years ago, and it was all about what is the benefit to society on various issues. And industry back then didn't really figure that. It was all about their shareholders. But now it is much more for big business, for progressive business, also for the European Commission. As you mentioned, the link between climate and social justice, well, and also economics and social justice, to get that right. So there has been transition, there is progress. We can say there's progress, and thanks to the FT, you've got a great new editor. I mean, you had a great old editor too, Lionel, but you have a great new editor too. So, and it's been so fascinating talking to you. I think we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to say, your book, The Fabulist, is just come out in, there we go, with a nice new cover.
No, this is actually the old one. I'm sorry, I didn't have the new one with me, but.
The new one has a nice red cover, I remember.
It does, yes. It's supposed to look distinguished and thoughtful, I think.
Yeah, Judy's going to post the link in the chat if anybody wants to read that. And then you see, then you get the insight, the real insights, and you've told it kind of from a story perspective around characters, right? About the characters, the different...
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, every encounter, it's not a work of political theory. It's a book about people who, you know, illustrate these bigger points, and including, in fact, somebody who's based in Brussels, who a university academic who has taken as one of her projects counting the dead in Syria's war. And I use this to tell the, you know, the story of the battle of narratives over Syria, you know, how some people are still sort of in denial about, you know, exactly who's been killing who there, and actually a really good example of what I'm talking about, which is using solid data, solid arguments to try and bring a bit of the truth to a very murky system.
Yeah, so all of that just tells us again that it is a book worth reading. It's not like reading the FT stocks and shares page, if that still exists.
I sincerely hope not.
Exactly. So it is something for everybody. And for those of you in the audience who've joined us today, thank you. This is about making sure that we can all progress together to change the mainframe. And if the mainframe has been adjusted without us really noticing, Michael has been able to kind of pull those threads together. And so we can really see through his book and through the stories of his book in the different regions of the world, how this kind of myth-making has a little bit pulled the wool over many people's eyes. So we haven't been able to really see what's been going on. But Michael, I would just like to say thank you to you very much. If you just stay on for just a second, Julia, you're going to tell us just in 2 minutes or 1 minute about the program for the rest of the year.
Hello. Hi. Yes. Sorry, I can't undo my video, but that's okay. I'll be very quick. Yeah, so not so much for the rest of the year, but we're definitely going to do another News and Views, as it's now called, before the summer. We'll announce that very soon. We've got a Facebook group, so if you're not there already, then please do join, and we'll also send news through Eventbrite. We've also asked people on the Facebook group to give us some subjects and topics that you'd really like to hear about. As Michael was just talking about, one of them we've seen a lot is digital storytelling. And so I think with Michael's the discussion on that earlier, that's a very relevant one. But still, please give us the ideas, and we will certainly be looking for another speaker very soon. So keep your eyes on that, join the Facebook group, and we'll hopefully see you all again soon. We'll also share a recording of this, and we'll also do a write-up, which I'll get in contact with you about, Michael.
Okay, so Michael, just another big thanks to you for joining us today, for sharing your insights, and for also being our inaugural News and Views muse today. I think you've inspired and enthused us all with hope. It's not all doom and gloom. It's not all finance. It's more about the modern times. And it's more about potential action. Although finance makes the world go round, there are other voices and a growing number of voices to make that finance socially just, environmentally sound, and all the rest that we need to live together on a healthy planet. So I would just like quickly say thank you again, Michael. Great insights there. Thank you, audience, for joining. Have a great rest of the afternoon. Thank you to Julia. Goodbye and good luck. We'll see you all soon. Take care.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks, Julia. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. Bye, all. Bye.
Very much.
Thank you.
Good to hear you. Bye.